9 uur op die kop.
Gaan
ons
met
ons vergadering beginnen, achtbare leiders. A warm welcome to those who cannot understand Afrikaans. On this Wednesday's meeting, to the department officials that are here, those that are going to be presenting, I can see Dr. Meller has no year. A warm welcome to all of you this morning. Let's get apologies, Valerie.
Good morning, Chair. There is an apology from Ms. Noluchungu, who has been deployed to assist with party business.
Okay. Thank you very much. Why are people praying now?
Deployments worry me.
Yeah. Okay. We'll talk about them when our visitors are no longer here. They also worry me. let me at this point in time, honourable members, greet Ms. Dr. Muller, and here if he's with us unmuted. We have a doctor.
I'm here.
Wow. Who can that?
Good, thank you, and yeah.
That can buy a good with me, thank you.
Afrikaans is not good either, I must say.
Yeah, no, thank you for coming. I understand you are alone today, the prof is not with you. We appreciate you taking time out of your schedule to come and talk to the committee about this bill. We want to give you this platform to address us. We will definitely have some clarity seeking questions, some comments at the end of your presentation. That is nothing more than us wanting to understand you more, so that by the time we sit, we have an understanding as to how do you think this bill should be shaped moving forward. Otherwise, the platform is yours, Doctor. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Chairperson, and good morning to the honourable members as well and other colleagues on the call. I'm just going to try and I have a PowerPoint presentation, so I'm just going to try and share the screen. Okay. Just to check, just to confirm, can you see the presentation?
Submission on the Economic Regulation of Transport Bill.
That's correct, yes.
By Dr. Sin M. Miller.
Yeah, indeed. So I'm just going to set it up correctly on my side. Okay, so I'm ready to start from my side, if that's okay with you, Chairperson.
Yes.
Great, thank you. Okay, so as already mentioned, this is a joint submission with Professor Mike Muller, who's at the Vitz School of Governance. He sends his apologies. He had some other meetings this morning that he couldn't get out of. And this presentation is partly based on a paper we drafted last year and presented at a economic regulation conference, which raises concerns about the regulatory model in South Africa as a whole. Both existing regulators, but also proposed regulators in the water sector and the transport sector. So that's really the background to this presentation. And thank you for the opportunity to present to the committee. Just in terms of a little bit of brief background, so my own background, I'm an economist. I actually worked, my first job was actually at the Department of Transport's Economic Analysis Unit. I have advised members on public finance matters while I was at the Parliamentary Budget Office, including on the financing of state-owned enterprises. And I've lectured on relevant subjects like public economics, microeconomics, and at present, industrial policy. My co-author is a former DG of Water Affairs and Forestry in the post-apartheid era, has also been a National Planning Commissioner, and he's consulted and advised extensively to local and multilateral institutions. His CV is much longer than mine, and I won't even try to go into it, but just to give you a sense of where we're coming from. And in the presentation invitation, we were asked to indicate who we represent. And I think what's important to say from our point of view is that we don't actually represent any interest group. Neither have we received any funding for this work that we've done. Our sole concern really is the public interest. So we have some concerns about the bill, which I'll elaborate on. And it's really coming from the perspective of what is the best thing for the country. And that's broadly conceived to include public transport users, freight users, the private sector itself, and of course the state in terms of the efficacy of its institutions and also issues like public finance and so forth. So that's our only concern. We don't represent anyone. And as I'll say later, also, we don't have any particular ideological commitments in this particular case. Our interest really is what is the best structure in terms of oversight of economic issues within the transport sector, what is the best structure, you know, in the public interest. So to start off really with our conclusion, Chairperson and Honourable Members, and it may be different to some other submissions. Again, in the invitation, we were asked to indicate which clauses of the bill we thought should be changed or whether we had any concerns about the constitutionality of the legislation. And we're actually not going to do either because our overall view is that the bill itself is not in the public interest. So we don't believe the bill should be passed. We don't think it's in the interest of transport users or the broader South African public, and we respectfully suggest that Parliament return the legislation to the executive and it be withdrawn for the foreseeable future. I mentioned the point about the foreseeable future because we're not saying that at no point in South Africa's economic development trajectory should there be a regulator of this kind. It may well be the case that, say, in 10 or 15 years' time, an economic regulator of this kind would be entirely appropriate. But our view is that isn't the case right now, and introducing such a regulator could be wasteful from a resource point of view and could actually introduce, it could make the problems in the sector worse. In instances like passenger rail, it might be hard to believe that things could get worse, but in fact they could. So our view is the legislation should be withdrawn, and we're not going to comment on a clause-by-clause basis. Just to give you an overview of the five main reasons we have for that conclusion. The first one is that the main issues in the transport sector are not related to price regulation. Okay? So if the concern is to address the challenges and the problems in the transport sector, then focusing on price regulation is really a distraction. The second reason is that the state already has power it is not exercising to resolve various pricing issues. The bill targets sectors where there are where a single participant has more than 70% ownership or comprises more than 70% of the relevant sector, and in those instances, it's typically public enterprises, and the stakeholder of those public enterprises is the state. The state has the ability to instruct state-owned enterprises and state-owned entities to conduct themselves in a different fashion. It's not necessary to introduce a regulator to do that. And furthermore, if there isn't that will on the part of the state, whether the shareholder, but also at a higher political level, then it's not clear that the regulator is going to be effective anyway. A third reason is that the regulator model has not worked in other sectors. I'll elaborate on that a little bit later, but energy is an obvious example. The fourth one is that the regulatory model that's proposed is quite costly. It duplicates capacity, and it requires scarce resources and skills that could be better utilized. This is true in general, but particularly now with the medium-term budget being presented today, I think we're going to see some quite scary numbers in the aftermath of COVID-19 and the lockdown, and neither of which, of course, is over. So we would have been concerned, and when we wrote this paper last year, we were already concerned about the extent of resources that would be required for this model. In the current situation, that concern is just severely exacerbated. And then finally, and this is what I was alluding to really in the second point as well, the solution to most problems in the transport sector is better political and public management. There's no way around that, with or without a regulator. So again, the danger is that the regulator is a costly distraction from the key problems and the solutions to those problems in the transport sector. So these are really our five main reasons, and I'm going to elaborate on those in subsequent slides. So again, as I said, this work is not just about the transport sector. We raised concerns about the failure of economic regulation in the energy sector, in particular in relation to ESCOM and NERSA, and also in the telecommunications sector. So the motivation for the paper was that we've seen these failures in these other critical sectors. And the approach of government at the moment, particularly driven by the National Treasury, seems to be to extend that model to other sectors, most notably transport. Transport is the largest and perhaps most significant and most complex sector that model is being proposed for. But there's also been a proposal to extend it to the water sector. That's an area of expertise of my co-author, who strongly argued against that. So our concern is really about the broad model, and there are additional reasons why we think that model is not appropriate at this point in time for the transport sector. But it's important that I convey those general arguments because, as I say, they carry over to this particular bill. So the first one is what I was alluding to, that South's economic regulation model for state-owned enterprises and state-owned entities has failed, in short. And much of the recent literature confirms that. So I give some references here. Whether it pertains to NERSA and ESCOM, whether it pertains to telecommunications regulation and ICASA and so forth, that regulatory model has failed. If, for example, we see I'll give examples in relation to ESCOM on subsequent slides. So the failure of that model indicates the need to reconsider it, we would suggest, and that's really just a straightforward logic. But there are other authors who propose, well, why don't we just tweak the model? Or even worse, they double down on the model. They say, well, what we really need to do is we need to just implement the model more robustly, despite decades of experience of that model not really working. And so our view is the model has failed in these other sectors over a significant period of time. That requires a complete reconsideration of the model. And certainly, we should not be expanding that model to other sectors without very good arguments as to why it's going to work better in those sectors than it's done in preceding sectors. Because the danger is if it doesn't, it's actually going to destabilize those sectors. I don't want to say that load shedding right now is solely to do with the regulatory model. It's not. But the regulatory model has been one of the contributory factors to the instability in the energy sector, most notably when it comes to the pricing path. But as I say, I mentioned that on a subsequent slide. And then finally, you know, the capacity requirements of this model are unrealistic and wasteful. We, instead of tackling a problem directly, which is in the control of the state, both because the state has the capacity to set policy, to draft legislation, but also because it's the main shareholder in the enterprises and entities that are believed to be not conducting themselves in the way they should. The state has the authority to address that directly. Instead, the current regulatory model sets up an entirely separate structure to try and resolve a problem which is already largely in the capacity of the state to resolve, and that alternative structure is only going to succeed with the same political will that would be required to address the problem in the first place. Okay. And in particular, in the context of South Africa's framing of itself as a developmental state. This is something that runs through many policy documents, but notably the National Development Plan. One of the critical issues for developmental states is optimal allocation of resources and skills. And we don't believe that one needs quite sophisticated skills for these kinds of regulatory models. And we simply don't believe that that is the best use of these skills in South Africa at this current juncture. So just to elaborate a little bit on our claim that the current model has failed, ESCOM and by association NERSA is the most notable failure. This quote from Fine in 2010 is just illustrative. He says, the electricity crisis is indicative of the absence of a developmental state in South Africa. Unlike any developmental state in the past, policy for electricity supply has effectively been devolved to a regulator with limited powers other than the short termism associated with pricing. That was in 2010. Here we are in 2020 with ESCOM and NERSA in the courts fighting each other using taxpayers' money. There's no win for South Africans at large. If ESCOM, as it currently has, wins that, then the public have to pay high electricity tariffs. If NERSA win that, ESCOM can't implement those tariffs, its financial situation is worsened, and the public has to bail it out anyway. So we have public funds being used for two institutions to fight each other in the courts, and either way, it doesn't change the fundamental reality of what South Africans are going to have to pay for electricity. So in what sense does that actually improve the situation? And just to emphasize some particular points in the context of that sector. First of all is one I mentioned already, which is that there's been an inconsistent and unpredictable pricing path for electricity. So now, given ESCOM's recent financial problems and partly because of its build program, we've seen a very rapid increase in electricity prices. And that's a function of the regulatory formula that NERSA used. But under a different model, we could have had a much smoother pricing path without the existence of an independent regulator. My co-author emphasizes the experience of the water sector, where the pricing path has actually been very smooth, quite reliable, and has been negotiated between, as I understand it, the department and key stakeholders. So that is what he refers to as regulation by contract. And that appears to have been effective in the water sector. The sector has also been affected by corruption and lack of skills in key posts. But again, those are not issues related to pricing. If one looks on the pricing side, water has done relatively well without an economic regulator, whereas in contrast, energy has done pretty badly with a relatively well-resourced, relatively sophisticated regulator. In the energy sector, we've seen failures within the utility, the shareholder department, the policy department, and the regulator. Okay, so one of the problems with this model is it's also quite complicated, and as I'll point out on a subsequent slide, it duplicates capacity unnecessarily. One of the big concerns right now, I think everybody appreciates, is our corruption and bad management issues. So those are amongst the main priorities of the current government, and rightly so. The regulator model that was used in the energy sector was evidently insufficient to protect from corruption, bad management, bad decision making. But interestingly, it's impeding efforts to deal with financial and operational crises. So I use this court case as an example. ESCOM has two crises. I've written about this elsewhere, an operational crisis and a financial crisis. And one part of a measured solution to the financial crisis would be to allow increases in tariffs. That wouldn't be the sole solution, as we've seen from many analyses. Somebody probably has to take on a large chunk of ESCOM's debt. But one part of spreading the pain of dealing with ESCOM's financial crisis would be to use tariffs. NERSA is actually blocking that. So we saw that with NERSA's decision to essentially remove the transfer that National Treasury made to ESCOM from its tariff consideration. So essentially it clawed back that money from ESCOM, which was given to it by Treasury to bolster its finances. Now, NERSA, I'm not suggesting that NERSA isn't doing its job by doing that. What I'm trying to demonstrate is that the Regulatory Model Act is actually obstructing solving the ESCOM problem, even though it didn't play a significant role in preventing it. Okay? So again, I'm just trying to illustrate the fact that this model hasn't worked in the energy sector, and at this point it's arguably counterproductive. a final point, which is quite relevant to the little narrative that has been provided with the current bill around access and private sector access to, for example, transport infrastructure, is that there's been a lot of hype around, for example, renewable energy and private power production, power generation. But the reality is that that's only going to worsen Eskom's financial situation. So yes, allowing greater private sector involvement in the energy sector will help to address the operational crisis in the sense that it will reduce the pressure from peak demand on Eskom's resources because private players are also feeding power into the grid. But it's going to exacerbate the biggest problem, which is Eskom's financial problem. And the same can be said of, for example, transport entities and enterprises. One can involve private sector players and try and increase, try and introduce some level of competition. But the consequence could be that the state is going to have to bail out the state-owned entities and state-owned enterprises affected by that. And one should then ask, well, why not deal with those challenges directly? And are people thinking about the unintended consequences of that approach? So I would like to say something about what appears to be driving the push for the expansion of this regulatory model, despite the evidence that's available that it's failed. And it seems to us that it's partly driven by outdated ideological commitments within the state. And these ideological commitments date back to the 1990s. So there was a push at that point in time, partly associated with GEAR, for what can be called structural adjustment type measures, which involves privatizing state-owned enterprises. And what's interesting, Chairperson and honorable members, is that this kind of thinking is in contrast to the developmental state approach. So in the developmental state approach, one thinks of state-owned enterprises as really key levers for the state to support and promote economic activity. The view that state-owned enterprises should be privatized, broken up, and regulated by independent regulators is more associated with a structural adjustment, Washington consensus type approach, which isn't really consistent with the developmental state model that's laid out, for example, in the National Development Plan. But there are some economists who really believe in this as a matter of faith. They believe that if there are problems in sectors where the state is dominant, then the only solution is to introduce economic regulation as a first step towards breaking up and privatizing the entities and enterprises operating in these sectors. And the evidence doesn't actually support that in the sense that different countries and different sectors within countries have quite different experiences. So one has to, it's not to say that there isn't a merit in some cases to privatizing state-owned enterprises. For example, for myself, I'm much more sympathetic to the idea that South African Airways should be privatized than I am to the idea that Metrorail should be privatized. So again, if one doesn't have these kinds of ideological commitments, one recognizes the need to tailor these sorts of policies to the industry and the sector in question, if what you're interested in is the public interest. There are, of course, vested interests who could benefit from some level of privatization that would be facilitated by an economic regulator. Our view, however, is that even if a small number of private sector players might benefit from such privatization, we don't think it's in the interest of even the private sector. So sometimes we see the private sector lobbying for these kinds of measures, for so-called structural reforms, which is really an umbrella sometimes. Structural reforms could mean anything, but in practice it's often an umbrella to smuggle in these kinds of reforms, these kinds of structural adjustment measures. We happen to think that to the extent the private sector is doing that, it's probably shooting itself in the foot. There's this notion that if one introduces greater private sector involvement in a particular sector, that will benefit the private sector at large, and that's false. Because if that private sector involvement just really involves those particular players benefiting from, for example, very beneficial public subsidies at the cost of destabilizing a particular sector, then the broader private sector is going to lose, even if those particular vested interests happen to benefit. And to some extent, one could argue that, there's a risk of that happening also with renewable energy producers, but that's a separate discussion. besides this issue of structural adjustment thinking, this notion that introducing economic regulation and greater private sector involvement will solve these problems is what unfortunately recently deceased but famous economist Pandikam Kandawiri called the pessimism of the diagnosis and the optimism of the prescription. So in other words, we don't deny, for example, that there are huge problems in the transport sector. We acknowledge that Transnet probably has been overpricing, especially when it comes to ports. We acknowledge that passenger rail is in a horrible state and has only been worsening. So when it comes to the diagnosis, we agree with much of the negativity. Of the diagnosis. The problem in kinds of narratives around these issues, there aren't detailed cases and convincing cases being made for how an economic regulator is going to resolve specific problems in these sectors. And I'll say a little bit more about that at the end of the presentation. So there's this disjunct. We pay a lot of attention to the detail of what the failures are, but then when it comes to the proposed medicine, it's very vague. And it ultimately rests on a sort of inherent belief that economic regulation and privatization will solve the majority of problems, when in fact it probably won't solve any of them at all. And then finally, and this is something that's really not being acknowledged at all by proponents of this model, is that there are serious and unacknowledged risks illustrated by nurses' failures in the energy sector. So the consequences of a regulator either not having the capacity to play its role properly or not having the political support to play its role properly, whatever. But if a regulator fails in its role, it can actually introduce greater instability into a sector and with significant consequences, for example, when it pertains to infrastructure investment and the pricing associated with that. Another example which is very pertinent to this bill is the UK's experience with vertical separation in rail, which led to a dramatic worsening in safety for passenger rail. So it's important to recognize not only is the specific case for an economic regulator quite weak, if not just absent altogether, but there are serious risks that come with introducing this kind of model. It's not a risk-free option. It's not just either the regulator is successful or it's ineffective. It could actually worsen the situation in some areas and in some sectors. Linked to these higher-level issues is our concern about developmental states and human capital. Many studies, both locally and internationally, cite lack of capacity and insufficient resources as reasons for the failure of regulators. But in the local case, these authors typically don't consider the broader implications of their analysis, namely that perhaps the regulatory model itself that we've adopted is simply not feasible given our level of development, given the resources we have, and given the many other demands on scarce resources and scarce skills. There are various authors, including Kandawiri, but also Hajun Chang, who note that one of the critical functions of developmental states is optimizing the deployment of significantly constrained resources. And so, you know, in saying this, we're also asking members to think about the fact, not just about the transport sector, but when one thinks about the economic regulations being proposed, to think, is this the optimal use of financial and human resources within the state as a whole?
Doctor?
They cannot be working for the executive. They cannot be working for the shareholder. So there's a very good chance, actually, that a regulator suitably resourced will actually take resources from these other entities that are actually critical for good outcomes. The existing model of economic regulation requires at least a triplication of capacity in the state-owned enterprise, and the regulator. So you need almost the same kinds of resources in three different public institutions in order to try and achieve a good outcome in this particular model. You could say it's actually in six different institutions if you include, if you separate the shareholder from the policy department, you separate the state-owned enterprise board from its management, and you add the national treasury. So potentially you need capacity in six different areas in the state to deal with one problem or to deal with one area. And we argue that that just doesn't make sense. So moving on to some specific illustrations relating to the transport sector, which hopefully will bring us a little bit closer to home in relation to this bill. Let's think about passenger rail. So rail in particular has been a sector that has been emphasized. I think in relation to an example of the kind of question we're saying should be asked. A critical question is, how will a transport economic regulator help matters in passenger rail? If the situation in passenger rail is one of the motives for introducing this regulator, which seems to be the case, seems to be part of the rationale provided, then we should be able to see a specific case, a specific argument for how the regulator is going to be resolving issues in that sector. My assessment, I don't think this is really contested, is that Metrorail is dysfunctional because of, amongst others, failing infrastructure, deteriorating rolling stock, bad management, rampant corruption, an unrealistic funding model, safety problems on the trains. Those are perhaps the main problems. Regulating prices is a complete irrelevance where rail is an option of last resort, as it is to many commuters. And when I say last resort, I also mean in terms of pricing, because, for example, it might be cheaper than minibus taxis that are available. And so the only likely benefit of the regulator would be facilitating privatization through access. Okay, and there have been some newspaper stories I see about this recently. For example, privatizing passenger rail or providing private access to passenger rail networks in Gauteng. But these private operators, precisely because of the nature of the service being provided and the people who are reliant on it, would almost certainly not be profitable without state subsidies. And furthermore, they would have to rely on similar resources, similar infrastructure, similar signaling infrastructure. Probably they might have to share rolling stock, or there might need to be some provisions made for that. So there's no reason to believe that introducing an economic regulator, even if it facilitates private access, is going to solve any of these problems. And again, it could worsen those problems. To return to the UK example I mentioned very briefly, the problem is, and the bill deals with this, I forget the specific sections, but the bill deals with questions around access and facilitating access. And it mentions briefly complexity. Now, we have a situation we've seen, fortunately not too many, but we've seen safety failures, we've seen accidents on the passenger rail network. Now, that's just where you have ultimately one operator, which is Metrorail. Now, if one were to believe that this is the model that this bill is going for, you're going to be having additional operators wanting to access that infrastructure at a time when the state-owned entity is currently struggling to manage access by itself to this infrastructure in a way that is safe for commuters. Now we're going to be introducing additional operators, and the coordination costs will rise significantly, and the coordination challenges. And if that went badly in the UK, which had a relatively well-resourced, relatively well-functioning passenger rail network, one has to ask why anybody would believe it's not going to make the situation worse in the South African case, where we don't have a rail network that's operating particularly well. I should say, as an aside, Chairperson and members, out of interest, that when I was working at Parliament between 2014 and 2016, I actually took Metrorail to work and back every day. So for 2 years, I did get a first-hand sense of what the challenges were on Metrorail, and I can't say that any of them related to pricing, nor did they ever look like they would be addressed through private access to the rail network. One thing I should note in this regard is Gautrain. Because sometimes when one has these discussions with people in this area, they say, well, Gautrain has worked really well. And their measure of that is the service that Gautrain provides, security, the quality of the rolling stock and infrastructure and so forth. The problem with that is that Gautrain is ultimately an elitist project, which tailors to people who have significantly more money than those who are using Metrorail. And furthermore, it's received huge subsidies from the state. It receives billions in subsidies from the Gauteng government every year. So that's just not a model that can feasibly be expanded without massive state funding. Our view is that although, for example, and again, it's important to separate personal or even class convenience, by class we mean social class, from the actual public interest aspects of these projects. So, for example, both myself and my co-author use Gautrain, and we very happily use it and we enjoy using the service. But when we step back and look at it from a public policy point of view and economics point of view, we recognize that it's a very large subsidy to privileged South Africans. And the idea that that is the model that one should use for providing a rail service to the millions of South Africans who rely on Metrorail is simply unrealistic. There's no relation between those models. It wouldn't have been, our view is, it wouldn't have been possible to put forward a credible cost-benefit analysis for the expansion of Gautrain prior to the COVID pandemic. Then the current situation where government's going to be having to cut down on its spending significantly, our view is frankly that it's an absurdity consider expanding that model. And it doesn't prove off private and passenger rail sector. A second example is port pricing. As I already mentioned, there are long-standing concerns about Transnet's port pricing. Again, when I was working in the Department of Transport, this was now 15, 16 years ago, it was one of the major issues considered by the National Freight Logistics Task Team. The thing is that it's also widely accepted that Transnet has cross-subsidized other operations using the excess profits from its port tariffs. The implication of that is if the prices are or were to be brought down, that greater state financing could be required for Transnet because Transnet is cross-subsidizing its other operations. So unless one can simultaneously find a way of reducing the costs of those operations, which seems unlikely given that that hasn't happened to date, then addressing the issue in the ports is going to require state financing to offset the removal of the benefits of that excess pricing. And that's arguably one of the main reasons why the issue hasn't been addressed, not because of the absence of a regulator. And we've seen that because the ports regulator, despite having, I think, been introduced in the mid-2000s, has largely failed to bring port prices down. I believe it's made some progress relatively recently. But arguably that failure illustrates the fact that if there isn't the political will, particularly from the shareholder, if there isn't the political will to tackle these issues, then introducing an economic regulator is not going to make a difference. But one can take that further and then say, well, if political will, and that's the lesson I put at the bottom of the slide, if political will is necessary for structural change, having a regulator is not the issue, because the regulator will be ineffective without sufficient political will, even though notionally it's independent, because the regulator operates within a particular policy framework and also requires resourcing from the state, the regulator is never going to be entirely independent, and it is going to rely on political will. So if that's the case, then we should rather ask ourselves, well, how can we develop the political will and the relevant steps to address these problems directly, rather than outsourcing them to a regulator, which is going to be expensive and probably ineffective anyway. Another example, which again is quite pertinent to this bill because of the emphasis on rail, is freight rail. So there was a period of time where with Transnet's freight rail service, even to its bulk clients, seemed to be decreasing in quality and reliability. Our sense is that that's improved in recent years. So again, the question is, what is the problem? What is the problem that this economic regulator might resolve? Well, one could argue that perhaps the rail infrastructure is being underutilized in terms of its capacity, that there's some potential for additional container traffic, which is also a higher value. And furthermore, Chairperson, Honorable Members, these are all issues that were discussed extensively back in 2004. Also potentially that some negative social externalities could be reduced by shifting freight from road to rail in a manner which Transnet has not managed to do on its own. So the argument is that by allowing private access, those private operators might be more effective in offering services that attract some of that traffic from road onto the rail. And those are all admirable intentions. But the question is, well, one question is, well, to what extent are these a problem? So what is, for example, the economic and social value, the potential economic and social value that could be obtained from facilitating these changes? Okay? And that's important if we're thinking about a cost-benefit analysis. But in addition, the question that follows is, does this require a regulator to resolve? And the answer is not necessarily, because the shareholder can instruct Transnet to facilitate access. Now, some experts in this area might laugh at that, because there have been instances where the shareholder has struggled to get Transnet to comply. But in law, it has the power to do so. So again, it comes back to a question of political will. Is the shareholder willing? Does the shareholder have the authority and the will to get the relevant state-owned entity or state-owned enterprise to conduct itself in the manner that they want it to? And if they do, then arguably they should try and do that in a direct fashion rather than initiating a process, which, by the way, is going to take a very long time, to set up a regulator with the hope that that regulator at some point in the future will manage to address these issues that the shareholder itself has failed to address. And as I mentioned, my co-author has suggested that a form of regulation by contract is a kind of alternative model to the one that's contained in this bill. It's a model that's worked in the water sector, which admittedly is a little bit less complex than transport. But the basic point is that there are alternatives. If our concern as individuals concerned with the public interest is with addressing these problems, then we should focus on the problems and not focus on coming up with what we hope is a solve-all approach through an economic regulator. Because as I've elaborated in the preceding slides, there are many reasons to believe that an economic regulator won't solve the majority of the key problems in the transport sector. And as a final point, I just want to recap those issues and also mention again the point about resources. So our view is that the single transport economic regulator won't resolve any of the critical issues in the transport sector. It could introduce institutional and systemic uncertainty for a significant period while it's being established. It could potentially further destabilize sectors through unreliable pricing, creation of complexity where existing capacity is failing, and by taking skills from where they're really needed in actual operations and management. And finally, it's likely to be very costly. So the socioeconomic impact assessment accompanying the bill suggested that the regulator will cost between 78 million and 133 million, requiring between 90 and 145 relatively highly qualified staff. And that report furthermore suggested that it emphasized that the view that greater resourcing was likely to be necessary in order for the regulator to be effective. In other words, at least the message we took from that report was that the higher estimates here are probably the more realistic ones. Again, the question we have to ask to honorable members is, if we had the resources to employ 145 highly qualified staff within the broader public service, would we want to put them in a transport economic regulator? Our argument is no. Even if the regulator was likely to have some of the benefits that have been argued. But as I've said from this presentation and from the paper that we've written, we don't even believe it will have many of those benefits. So in short, we think that the idea of this economic regulator is a bad one, and it should be withdrawn for the foreseeable future. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. We have heard you. In short, as you put it, this is a bad idea. There must be a political will to drive this department. We want to thank you for your presentation. And I can see we already have a hand of Honorable McDonald. Mondise, you are next. Honorable Hansinger, you are next. And we'll then look at those who can't raise their hands using this. this technology. And that Dijabang, we understand.
And Honorable May.
And Honorable May, these are our veterans, we must respect them. Okay, let's start. Honorable McDonald.
Good morning, Chair. Thank you very much. Partly good morning to all the honourable members. Firstly, I would like to thank Dr. Sean Miller for his presentation. It was a well-presented presentation. I would have loved to have had the document. I don't seem to have this presentation of his on email, but I'm sure you can forward it to us. It was very enlightening. It was a lesson in economics. I only have maybe one question. In his humble opinion, would he support that Transnet and Prasa become one entity, thus cross-subsidizing some sectors of Prasa Transnet to make it a more viable entity? Because I've read Dr. Sean's CV and wow, he is definitely qualified to answer that question. So that is my question to Dr. Sean Miller. Thank you very much, Chair.
Let's get the next speaker, Honorable Mondise.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. Greeting to all our members. And thank you for the presenters for the presentations. It was an eye-opener because there's a lot of things that he has said. But there's the few things that I want to understand from Mr. Moura. The first one, he said the metro rail should be privatized. What I want to find out, why did he say that? And the other one, he says the passenger rail is in terrible state. And what's the reason? What is the input from their entity, from their sectors? And then another question, I'm trying to understand when there was a three main component to the argument. The first one was South African economic regulations model for SOEs has failed. If you can actually elaborate on that one. And the other one is that you say the capacity requirement for the model, the model are unrealistic and wasteful. If you can actually make us to understand why did you say that? And the last one, Chairperson, says the SOEs and regulators model was insufficient to protect from corruption, bad management, and bad decision making, but it is imperative effort to deal with the financially and operationally crisis. If you can actually unpack the last one, I can be very grateful, Chairperson. And the last one says if the bill can go forward, it will need more operators, if I understand you. So if you can tell us, why did you say that? Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Masibonge, Joe. Kamaja. Honorable Hansinger.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you very much, Dr. Sean, and also to Professor Mulder through you. And thank you very much for a very thorough analysis and perspective shared, and in particular, the value that was gained through your personal experience in having dealings with the department, with the parliament, with all the entities and so forth. Dr. Sean, in various submissions that we've heard till now, there was this underlying fear that what is envisaged in terms of the role and function of this regulator, that certain overlaps are feared to come into existence with the current work of the Competitions Commission. Could you share your ideas about the success and positive role of the Competition Commission, but then the limited scope of their role and function, and therefore the justification from that perspective that there might be an area for a economic regulator of transport. Then I would also like to hear your views, either in theory or in practice, since you've very successfully and convincingly made a comparison of the various models, but then specifically against the regulatory bill, but mentioned alternatives like a contract bill, for a contract model, for instance. But then certainly there is an argument in terms of the important triangle in economic terms that needs to be regulated given a developmental state, where you would manage participation in order to attain a full developmental state with full participation. So how would a contract model then successfully do this opposed to a regulatory model where you allow participation and where you open up access in an developmental state model? But then specifically, given the fact that, as you have said, that transport, but particularly then public transport, rail specifically, is a subsidized service and that it can really function without any government subsidy. So the relationship between this subsidy, the regulation of fares, and then price stability over time. Surely there's a role to play, and I do accept that what you say, this can be done by the SOE, you don't need a regulator to do that. But then particularly in the public transport sector, to then develop and manage this particular balance, which definitely currently is not in place. I would also like to just hear your ideas, particularly in areas of international and global competitiveness, attaining the competitive edge, of the role of a typical regulator then to improve and align competitiveness. I'm thinking of harbor import-export activities in particular. Thank you, Chairperson, and thanks again, Dr. Shaw.
Thank you, Honorable Hansinger. Let's take Adetcha Bangu.
Thank you, Chair. Let me also welcome the presentation made by the DOC. The first question is, which plans does the DOC have in mind to help the SOEs to conduct themselves accordingly and to make them serve their purposes of creating jobs and being vibrant in the sense of bringing profit and not always wanting to be bailed out by the government? The second question would be, DOC, places like Malaysia and Singapore are depending on ports for their entire lives, and they regulate prices of the ports the way they deem it right or fit. And as a result, they create jobs look after their people and build houses out of the profit made out of the ports. Is there anything wrong if the government controls the prices of the port? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honorable McDonald, have I skipped you?
No, Chair, you didn't skip me. I didn't blow my hand. Apologies, Chair.
Thank you very much. Geachte Piet May.
Thank you, Chairperson. I would like to congratulate Dr. Miller on his excellent presentation. It is by far the best presentation I've listened to so far, pointing out the positive and the negative aspects. I only want to say I agree 100% with Dr. Miller. Thank you, Dr. Miller.
Thank you, Honorable Piet May. Thank you.
Yeah, well informed.
Yes. Thank you very much. Boramado.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, for the opportunity. Let me start by thanking the presentation. Chairperson, mine is just a question for clarity. During the presentation, Doctor indicated that, or in his presentation, he indicated that South African economy regulation model of SOE has failed. My question is, what must happen so that regulator model succeed? And he must be specific to transport. Secondly, he spoke of Eskom. We know that in South Africa, we are an unequal society. I thought maybe he will also include solar system so that we are all covered. Thank you, Chairperson. That's my submission.
Ndole Buangamanda Buramadwa. Could you please lower your hand? Honorable Ramadwa, please lower your hand. Maybe the network. Doctor? Is the doctor still with us? Dr. Miller?
I am with you, Chair. The connection is just breaking up occasionally.
Okay. You had the positive and the negatives, the objective and the subjective. And please respond, sir.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you to the honourable members for the questions and comments. There are many good questions, some of which probably require answers, which I'm not going to have time to provide. Chair, you'll guide me in terms of time, but I'll take them in order, starting with Honourable McDonald. The first question was about merging Transnet and PRASA in order to facilitate cross-subsidisation. Again, I can't speak obviously for my co-author, he's not here, but we do tend to share similar views on these issues. I doubt we would be in favor of that. So the thing is, honorable members, there are instances in which cross-subsidization can serve a legitimate purpose. It's not something that one generally seeks to encourage, because from a standard economic perspective, and in fact from most perspectives, it can be inefficient. So in other words, So there is actually a report that I produced for the Standing Committee on Finance back in 2015 on financing state-owned enterprises, and members may be interested in that. One of the views that is summarized there is from organizations like the OECD, where they advocate what they call competitive neutrality. So they argue that state entities shouldn't be allowed to engage in that kind of activity. Rather, the state should estimate what the costs are of the operation that is needing the cost subsidy and fund it directly. Okay, so the argument for that is one around transparency and accountability. And in principle, it's a good argument. So in other words, it doesn't say that the state shouldn't fund it. It says that the state should estimate and fund it in a transparent fashion. The problem is that practically it can be quite hard to estimate those amounts, and cost subsidization is perhaps an easier, within an enterprise is an easier solution. But I doubt there's a strong case to be made for merging CrossFit and Transnet, particularly given that in fact there's been a move to separate them. There are good reasons to believe that the passenger rail and freight rail should operate independently. So I'm not sure we would advocate that. There is the bigger question of how to make passenger rail financially feasible, and this touches also on a subsequent question. I think it was by Honorable Hunsinger about the regulation of fares and subsidy. So the issue there really, Honorable Members, is that one needs to get a clear sense of the kind of financing requirements for PRASA to operate in the kind of way we would want it to, in other words, in providing the service that working class Africans deserve from public passenger rail. And then based on that funding requirement, then one should ask, well, how best can one obtain those funds? And my suspicion is that actual tariffs, in other words, the actual fares, are probably not likely to be the most significant components of that. Just to draw by analogy to another state and entity where the funding mechanism is in the news right now is the SABC. SABC has been trying to rely on TV licenses. It's a model that clearly doesn't work for a variety of reasons, some of which may have to do with the ability of the majority of South Africans to pay that amount. And arguably it may make more sense to fund that through general tax revenue. The same may be true for PRASA, which is not to say that Metrorail shouldn't charge fares, but the fares may not be the most significant component of their funding model, and which implies that the state will have to fund it in some way or another. That links to the question from the second honorable member, whose name I didn't get because the network broke up, about whether we were saying the metro rail should be privatized. No, in fact, what we're probably saying is the opposite. So there is some talk, there is some hype around the possibility of introducing private sector involvement in passenger rail as a means of improving the current fairly dire situation with service delivery there. Our view is that that's unlikely to resolve the problem because the underlying issues are not about competition. And they're not about price regulation. They're about bad management. They're about the need for greater infrastructure investment and rolling stock investment. There were initiatives to remedy that, and in particular on the rolling stock side. Unfortunately, there was large-scale corruption, which is now being dealt with at the Zondo Commission. So those are the kinds of issues that need to be resolved, and we don't think that privatization of Metro Rail is going to resolve the problem. In particular, neither is increased private competition at this stage of our development and given where our public institutions are. As I've said, hopefully, in fact, in the future, these fundamental problems will have been resolved to such a degree that we can at least consider the merits of introducing private sector competitors into the passenger rail space. That it seems very unlikely to me that's going to happen in the next 10 years at the earliest. And we would need significant improvements and significant economic growth before that's feasible. The second honorable member also asked about the three main components of the argument. I can send through the presentation, which I think may be useful, and apologies for not sending that in advance. So I don't think I have time to recap all of those points. We So the three main components of the general argument were, first, that South Africa's economic regulation model of state-owned enterprises has failed. We argue that's quite clear in the telecommunications and energy sectors, and even authors who argue in favor of the economic regulation model accept that those failures have taken place. Excuse me. The second is that we believe those failures indicate a need to reconsider the entire model rather than just tinkering with it or tweaking it. And certainly that given those failures, we should not be thinking about extending that model to other sectors, precisely because we risk the same failures happening in those sectors. And we don't want to end up with a situation where freight rail, which is operating okay right now, it may not be optimal, it may not be attracting as much high-value traffic as we'd like, but it's doing all right. What we definitely don't want to do is harm freight rail because of a regulator that comes in and starts setting tariffs in destructive ways like NERSA did in the energy sector. And then the final part is capacity requirements being unrealistic and wasteful. That was the point that also I ended the presentation on, Chairperson, which is the number of highly skilled staff and the hundreds of millions of rand required for this regulator annually. We just don't believe that's a good use of public resources in general, and definitely not in the current situation in a post-COVID-19 world. Moving on to the questions of Honorable Hunsinger. The first one was about the Competition Commission and overlaps with their mandate. That's a very big question, and that is one of the cases where in terms of thinking about the overlap, one does actually have to look a little bit on a clause-by-clause basis, and legal experts will be better to do that. But the high level of thinking about economic regulation, one could argue that the Competition Commission's mandate doesn't really allow it to intervene in sectors where there really isn't any competition. So the question is, does the Competition Commission have a role to play when it comes to port pricing if there aren't any port competitors? So the Competition Commission has played a role, for example, in aviation because South African Airways has competitors. But Transnet doesn't really have competitors in the ports, or at least in various core port functions. And so that's just one obvious case where the Competition Commission's mandate doesn't allow them to play that role. My overall view of the Competition Commission is quite positive at this point, but the Honourable Member is correct that their mandate is limited. So then the question is, well, what do we do about these areas where they can't be involved? And that comes back again to the question of what is the appropriate model for the shareholder to use to ensure that these state-owned enterprises and state-owned entities conduct themselves in the manner that they would want to. The analogy I gave, and unfortunately my co-author will be able to elaborate on that a bit more, is in the water sector, where the department decides bulk water prices, but in discussion with stakeholders. And by and large, stakeholders seem to have been relatively happy with the decisions that have been made. There's no reason why a similar model, to our knowledge, there's no reason why a similar model couldn't be followed in the case of something like port pricing, in which the shareholder could direct Transnet and its relevant subsidiary in terms of the kinds of the approach they should take to setting prices without the involvement of a regulator. But of course one would have to, and this also touches on questions from other members, Honorable Chabangu, Honorable Ramadwa, which is about what are the alternative models as well. We've mentioned the regulation through contract model as an example. The water sector provides an illustration. But we also need to reiterate the point we made that the approach needs to be tailored to the relevant sector. And so we wouldn't want to commit the same sin that we're criticizing this bill for, namely taking a generic model and applying it to all the sectors. While we need to think about the challenges and the problems in the particular sectors and design the model and who the stakeholders are and design the relevant model accordingly. I made a point about managing participation in order to attain a development state, and certainly we would agree with that. So again, we don't, for example, take a view against competition. competition plays a key role in all market economies. South Africa is a market economy. It happens that the state has certain key levers within its control through state-owned enterprises and should be using those in order to pursue a developmental state. But certainly greater private sector involvement can be beneficial. The question again, though, is you say how to facilitate that. Well, let's take the example of Eskom. And again, this is often where we see public discussion not being consistent with the facts. There's an argument that we need to separate Eskom into these three parts in order to facilitate private sector involvement. But we know that's not true, because renewable energy independent power producers are already supplying power to Eskom. Why? Because by policy and by law, they were, and by the shareholder, they were instructed to. So those REIPP contracts, there were bids, the bids were signed by the state. The state provided power price guarantees, which, by the way, form a significant part of our contingent liabilities now. So the state played a key role in facilitating private sector power generation, despite the fact that Eskom is essentially has been a monopoly in that area. And Mercer had not been critical to that process. That process could have happened without Mercer. So it is possible to come up with models that facilitate private sector involvement in these areas, like freight rail, without necessarily having an economic regulator. And possibly those models could be more effective with lower costs because they're driven internally. Again, I think it's really important to repeat the point that whatever capacity one has in the economic regulator, there's still going to have to be some comparable capacity in the state-owned enterprise itself and in the shareholder, at the least, but probably also the policy department. So if that capacity is in those departments, then one can use that capacity to develop and implement these models. If it's not in those entities, then the regulator is arguably not going to be able to succeed either, because the regulator, for example, could instruct Transnet to facilitate access in a certain way. But if Transnet doesn't have the capacity, well, it's just not going to happen. Or if it doesn't have the, or if there isn't the political will to induce it to do so. So these kinds of models do need to be thought about. The focus of our paper has really been raising concerns about the existing model and the extension of it. And as I say, we use the contracting model as an example, but we haven't fleshed out very detailed models for these sectors. And to be honest, honorable members, although we're of course very understanding that, and it's quite appropriate that this is the question that many of you are asking, but our view is also that those people within the states who are paid to do this full-time are the ones who should apply themselves to thinking about these alternative models. Unfortunately, my co-host and I also have a lot of other commitments and we don't have time to draft full models in this regard. The final question about by Honorable Huntsinger was about international competitiveness and the role of regulators. I think, again, we're completely on board with the issue around international competitiveness. Arguably, South Africa has to some extent been shooting itself in the foot by having excessively high port tariffs. Why? Because it increases the cost of imports and imported inputs into the production process, and it makes exports less competitive. I teach industrial policy, and this is exactly the kind of thing that one worries about. So in that sense, the cross subsidy is undesirable. But if those other operations of Transnet are inherently loss-making and serve an important public function, then they need to be financed by the state in another way. Introducing a regulator, again, it's neither here nor there, honorable members, because the state has the power to prevent Transnet from engaging in that activity. Maybe it would need to develop a little bit more internal capacity in order to make sure that the instruction that gives in terms of what are appropriate prices are indeed correct. Because one thing we also need to remember that the danger of forcing state-owned enterprises to price below what they need, for example, for future infrastructure investment, maintenance, and so forth, is that one can destroy those enterprises too. So underpricing is also something to be concerned about, not just overpricing. So international competitiveness is certainly what we should be thinking about when we think about freight transport. But again, the question is, what is the best way of resolving the problems of identified? And rarely ever is it actually an economic regulator in the South African context. Moving quickly on to Honorable Chabangu, the first question was about what plan to have in mind to get the SOCs to deliver and achieve the desired results. Well, I mean, it might sound trite, but you know, the main solution is competent people and good management. And it might sound trite, but I do think that that is the approach that the current government is taking to ensure that there are competent and qualified people acting in the public interest at the head of state-owned enterprises. They have the relevant skills, and they will drive that downward. They will ensure that the people who are working for them also have the relevant skills and so forth. The only solution is to have these entities and enterprises run properly. Again, to point out that sometimes there's this notion that, well, if we were to privatize them, that would be a faster solution. Well, not really, because we also need to remember the private sector are pursuers of profit. In fact, that's to some extent their legal mandate. So if a private sector player comes into a sector that's dysfunctional and where the incumbent is able to abuse their market power, then we might just put an inefficient public monopoly with an inefficient private monopoly, which cannot be directed to act in the public interest in the same way. So there's no, and this is the point I think we made on one of the slides, there's no way around improving public management of these sectors, of these enterprises within these sectors. There's no way around that. An economic regulator might present the illusion that we can get around that problem, but we can't. The second question was, is there anything wrong with government controlling prices at the ports? I think I already indicated our view on that. The answer is no. It really depends how government controls those prices. So if the government controls those prices in such a way that it's used, that ports prices are used to subsidize other efforts to an extent that it harms the country's competitiveness, then arguably that's undesirable and it needs to be remedied. But our view is that there's no intrinsic obstacle to government properly managing the prices of the ports. And a regulator is neither necessary nor sufficient to ensure that that happens. Finally, moving on to the question of Honorable Ramadra, what should happen for the regulatory model to succeed? Well, you know, we've adjusted the definition that we just don't think the regulatory model, what can we think a different model is required, which secure resources that focuses those on leveraging the authority of the shareholder and the authority of the state over these enterprises and entities. But you know, we could think to the future and say, well, what would be required for these models to work in the future? And I think first of all, one needs these fundamental issues in the sectors to be resolved. That's the context in which economic regulators can play a good role. So, for example, you know, when I teach industrial policy, there's an author, Weiss, who has a typology of the different kinds of industrial policies that are useful at different stages of development. And so I could rephrase our view in the context of that framework, which is that as South Africa's economic sectors develop, as the economy grows, the demand for these services will increase. The quality of the services will increase as well. Hopefully these fundamental issues will have been addressed. And at that point, there might be greater, and if there's high demand, at that point, there might be greater merit to private sector involvement and private sector competition. In that context, this kind of regulatory model could work, and it could be useful, and we could have the public resources in order to finance the model, finance the existence of these regulators with the capacity they need. So what we're arguing is that at the current stage of development, with the current state of these relevant components of the transport sector, this model is just going to be a costly distraction. It could be harmful. So what we're proposing is a simpler model which leverages the authority that the shareholder already has and looks something like a regulation by contract model, a more complex version of what's happening in the water sector. I didn't quite catch the last question about solar systems, which I assume refers to solar power generation and inequality. Chair, I don't know if I can ask Honorable Ramadra to repeat that or whether we have time for that. Thank you.
No, thank you, Doctor. Honorable Ramadra had said maybe you should touch on the benefit of using solar energy.
Solar energy in the transport sector or solar energy in the power generation sector?
Power generation sector, because at that particular time you mentioned Eskom as an example.
Right.
So she can.
Okay. Yes. No, so, I mean, there are lots of very good arguments for increasing renewable energy, most notably concerns around global warming, pollution, emissions, and so forth. We're not in any way opposed to renewable energy. The point that I was making, though, is that the involvement of independent power producers, particularly renewable energy independent power producers, has been touted as a solution to ESCOM's problems and linked to arguments for privatization and separation of ESCOM. But first of all, the introduction of renewable energy power producers, including solar power producers, is going to worsen ESCOM's financial situation, first of all. But second of all, it can be facilitated and is being facilitated with ESCOM in its current structure. And the regulator is not playing the key role there. So in fact, it's a nice example of how, first of all, private involvement doesn't resolve the majority or the fundamental problems in a sector. Second of all, it can exacerbate some of those, in this case on the financial side. And finally, that the regulator is not a critical player in that process, because private sector involvement can be facilitated, and this also talks to one of the questions earlier. Government can construct mechanisms. So, for example, there are some economists who recently won the Nobel Prize for Auction Theory, and there have been some criticisms about that award because it seems quite irrelevant to the world as it is right now. Maybe that's true, but one of the interesting things about auctions is that they can be used to create a quasi-competitive environment. This is something that's quite important in the industrial policy literature. So even when we don't have competition in the normal sense, the normal market competition sense, where, for example, you have multiple retailers selling similar products and they compete with each other on price, you have a sector that's dominated by a government enterprise and where access is regulated, but not necessarily through an economic regulator. The question then is, well, the argument is, well, that's not competitive, and if we want competitive outcomes, we must privatize. No, not necessarily, because when it comes, for example, to renewable energy, the way that was facilitated was through bidding auctions. So you create a quasi-competitive process. So the private sector, they compete with each other in bidding for these power generation contracts, and that simulates a competitive process, which the state can then benefit from through lower generation prices. I hope that addresses the question.
Are you done, Doctor?
Yes, Chairperson, thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your presentation and your response. We will take your inputs as we move forward, like all other inputs, and see how best can we come up with a tool that will enable us to take South Africa forward. Thank you very much, Doctor.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members.
To pass our regards also to the professor.
I'll do so. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Submission by Ntate Ufenze Mukwena. Kwena.
Good morning, Honorable Chairperson.
Ongrile
ke tswara nku.
Eh, no ke o bona hore tswa ho finyana mona ha yeso garankuwa jwale o so ja ja tlhapi. Fela la o le jwalo he ga dem kwena. Re o file platform ya o bua le rona morena. Eh, ke a gola tla sebedisa sona se ja tlhapi fela re tla utlwa. Ne re re ketellong ya ditaba ya o ketle o bua taba tsao. O kana lebella dipotso le ditlhakisetso go tswa go maloka a tlhompega a ntlo ena. Ke a leboga mre.
O leboga nna, o leboga nna. Okay. I've just shared the screen. Good morning, honorable members. I'll be presenting some of my comments with regard to the economic regulation of transport bill. And of course, the views that I'm expressing here don't represent any entity or institution, although I'm coming from the Northwest University here in Mafikeng. So about me, just broadly speaking, I'm from Harangua. I've been in the transport teaching and research space for some time now, and largely dealing with transport economic issues and issues related to logistics management. So just a broad overview of this bill. The first point of departure is understanding how the transport policy environment works and figuring out where the bill fits in. And largely the conversation around the bill leans more towards, or appears to lean more towards, you know, strategic assets. And this is at the far end of the spectrum. And these strategic assets or network industries feed in or interact with the remaining transportation policy environment. So we have the issues that are in the national domain, and then we've got some issues that are in the provincial and municipal domain. And at the provincial and municipal environment in the red, that's where you find much of the transport planning and much of the public transport activities. And it's a really complex environment. But at the same time, on a more national level in terms of functions, you see your railways and your major roadway infrastructure is usually associated with that. And that's, of course, attached to the Department of Public Enterprises. But what's interesting specifically with regard to this bill is the gap that the bill does not seem to communicate with its regulatory counterparts, particularly those that deal with the minibus taxis, ride-hailing, bus transport, and other economic entities that require economic regulation. And that is where really the basis of the line of questioning that I'll be presenting comes from. So the basis of this bill is appears to be driven by three major reports, one from a position paper from National Treasury, of course. The other one is from the reports by the National Planning Commission on how to reform South African state-owned enterprises, and also on the white paper on rail transport policy. But now the challenge here is that the motivation seems to be related to addressing the structural issues that we've had in our economy. And one of the main arguments is that by removing the structural issues, we'll then unleash or open the market up in a deregulated kind of fashion, and removing the existing monopolies. But then the principles are really driven by something that has been on the table for quite some time, especially with regard to state-owned enterprise reform. And that's a report by the Department of Public Enterprises that was published in 2000 and was all about, you know, moving state-owned enterprises from where they are. They still are where they are today, 20 years later, but moving them towards more marketized, more commercial, and very well-governed entities. And this bill is a bit challenging because it on one hand leans on regulating network industries in the transport space, but on the other hand, it also creates some confusion in terms of the policy signaling that you expect with regard to what happens in the public passenger transport environment, particularly with regard to the issues that we see from the Competition Commission. So the market inquiry is a really instrumental element. And one thing that the bill is clear about, which is standard practice in economic regulatory literature, is that the relationship between the Competition Commission and the economic regulator that's proposed, it's quite an intimate relationship. And in many ways, the market inquiry was setting the scene largely for this this regulator. But the challenge is that you know, the issues in the meter taxi, minibus taxi, bus transport, and shared transport environments are not explicitly presented in this particular bill. And even in the case or the even in the impact assessment, the stakeholders who are part of that discourse are not necessarily coming from these dimensions of the transport environment, and they're the ones that interact with directly with their municipalities and provinces in terms of transport planning. So it creates a bit of an interesting scenario, and it's made worse by the push for devolving transport functions that we see in key provinces where they would like to have responsibility around the railway infrastructure, which is also part of this bill. So there is a bit of a need for clarity. And it's specifically because, you know, the bill is aiming to, you know, developing small and medium enterprises, and you know, part of the sector does involve various small enterprises, micro enterprises that have not been opened up or exposed to deep economic regulation. But at the same time, the writing and the language leans more towards the network industry. So this bill that's currently available, it's very different from, relatively different from the previous version of the bill from February 2018, which did have a much more detailed discussion about its coordination and cooperation with provincial and municipal authorities. So there are a couple of scenarios from an analytical perspective that I'm concerned about. The one is whether this bill is really leans more toward the economic regulation of rail transport, which would enable, you know, the removal of structural issues, but at the same time, it would largely be about separating infrastructure from operations. And at the same time, it would also put a lot of pressure on the existing Transnet and PRASA to actually exercise their functions to tap into the Succession Act in terms of accessing and participating and developing joint ventures with private stakeholders. But then in the middle, we have another scenario in which we have the economic regulation of network industries in transport. In this case, then we then expand the scope where maritime aviation, guided transport, for example, rail and roads, road infrastructure in particular, under the South African Road Agency Limited, would fall under this type of regulatory title, at least. And that is much, in my view, that is much closer to what this bill is covering. Then when we move towards the existing bill as it is, you know, it is inclusive of all transport modes, issues and industries. And then would also need to incorporate regulatory authorities as per the definition in the bill. But this will require much deeper analysis by the economic regulator rather than simply relying on commentary and submission. It would require actual assessment of the market conditions. And it would also require absorbing inputs from the market inquiry from the Competition Commission and also the outcomes of the Texile Quota, and also accounting for the various changes in the shared transport environment. So, but then it would also require, you know, bringing back Chapter 2, Part A of the initial 2018 bill, specifically Section 5, which basically covers this provincial and municipal cooperation issue with regard to economic regulation. So drafting the comments, there were a couple of assumptions that I had made. There are specific comments at the end that are directed to specific clauses. But in drafting them, the first assumption is, well, you know, it is one of the directions of the bill to only applicable to strategic assets, or the economic regulator will not be interfacing with provincial regulatory entities and planning authorities directly. You know, but there are some other, you know, variables in that. And then the last one is that the transport interchanges are assumed, or intermodal facilities are assumed, to be part of the network infrastructure. But now the comments here assume that, you know, the inputs are necessary. So what I'll be sharing is necessary for network industries, but also the bill might want to lean into passenger transport and the free freight transport market, which refers to the trucking, the road freight industry in particular. As you might have noticed, that there have been a lot of conflicts and a lot of issues in the road freight industry, and the competitive activities that are happening there are actually basically the returns that are diminishing for the players in the road freight industry. And again, you know, we still have a mandate from the DOT and the Department of Energy around, you know, shifting consignments from road to rail. So that's another variable that that we might need to consider. So broad remarks with regard to these opening notes. The first one is that you know, it should rather be around regulating infrastructure, access to infrastructure in particular, but then expanding the scope across various other transport infrastructure. And you'll see that the definitions, I also proposed some changes in some of the definitions in this regard. And then also reconnecting the bill with the key points of service delivery, which are provinces or provincial regulatory entities, transport authorities. You can see them in Gauteng, Cape Town, and we need more of them as per the white paper on national transport policy. And also real focus on understanding what the bill implies for entities like the minibus taxi industry, ride hailing, and meter taxi sector, and also the bus transport sector. And you'll see those remarks, this remark being attached to other comments. So my key recommendations are largely that we need to absorb a much more South African outlook in terms of what we're doing in this bill. And in that regard, we have to account for, of course, our taxi industry, ride hailing, micro cargo, which is basically the movement of goods through non-motorized transport on small vehicles, and bike sharing and other transportation modes. But then some of the things that are far reaching in terms of these particular issues relate to the medallion approach, which is basically about having a value for each route. So every route in the transportation sector has a specific value, and that value is what is traded in the transport market. And that is also something that the families or the transport operator and the owner of that medallion can transfer to their families. And also following the white paper on national transport policy, you know, pursuing the implementation of this transport authorities within this kind of economic regulatory bill. And furthermore, reviewing the scenarios that I've outlined before. And, you know, the last one, number four, is really a key issue here with regard to what we saw with a new policy, like, for example, a carbon tax act now. It initially started off through the national white paper on climate, the national climate paper. It was a response paper. And then you had the discussion document on carbon tax. And then you had the bill. Then of course, we have the act. And then there are subsequent regulations, and it was rather concerning to see that the bill was yes, coming from the white paper of national transport policy, but the economic regulatory issues that require a discussion document you know, did not really materialize, and all we have is this act. So the rationale around various statements is unclear for stakeholders involved. So it is very likely that the bill is timely for strategic industries, but it may also be premature for the broader transportation sector. So it's relevant for specific industries, but it might be very early for other industries as well. So in terms of direct comments to the bill, so with regard to the definitions, there are a couple of definitions that I reinstate, and others I just add value to them. The first one is with regard to the Municipal Transport Authority, and it was removed in the initial bill. And one of the things that I'm highlighting here is that it might need to be reinstated unless if the term regulatory authority is inclusive of of these structures as per the National Land Transport Act. But also there is a need to have much more clarity, whether it's in writing or what have you, around, you know, how this bill interacts with the provincial regulatory entities, public transport regulator, and the operating license administration system, specifically from an information management perspective, because the bill also requires substantial information from the entities that will be involved in the entities that will be regulated in this particular regard. But then there's also a definition around, you know, economic regulation. And in this particular case, you know, one of my point here is that we have a lot of issues around, you know, fixed price and cost plus regulation. But the balancing act is extremely important, especially when it comes to managing public funds. So you want to get as much as you can from the public funds that is invested. So what I recommend, though, is that we might need to have much deeper sections that discuss, you know, the effort exerted associated with the cost to produce a certain level of service as prescribed by the regulator. So the definitions of service levels and service conditions must be added, and they also, you know, including these will also then may influence the prohibited acts that are indicated in the section. Then in terms of transport sector, the definition of the transport sector is actually, when you look at it at first, it's appropriate, but shipping is actually a part of the maritime you know, environment, the maritime industry, and rail transport is fine, you know, but given the fact that technology in guided transport is going to evolve relatively quickly, I'm also proposing that, you know, we use the term guided transport in substitution of rail. For now, it's just an option. But most importantly, at least for me, is that the exclusion of pipeline transport is not consistent with the National Transport Master Plan, largely because, you know, it is part of the transportation sector and it should be part of that definition, although the function from a regulatory perspective is somewhere leaning towards NERSA. In terms of market, you know, the definition of market in the bill is absolutely accurate. It's okay, but the bill is focused on economic regulation of transport, and therefore, you know, it needs to be very specific, and largely because the transport sector, you've got one mode for a trip, and you can also have multiple modes being used for a trip, and therefore, if you were going to then classify market power, you know, it makes it a very complicated classification. So, my recommendation is that, you know, the term transport market is used with regard to the market. You know, we must use the term transport market so that it describes the various transport modes within themselves, and also the passenger and or freight volumes in the product that is being transported. So it could be passenger seat kilometers or ton kilometers that constitute a dimension of how a market is defined, rather than just saying a place where goods and services are exchanged at a few. That is insufficient for this type of policy. And in terms of infrastructure, you know, it's something that might need to be considered, specifically intermodal infrastructure, because although it might seem like it's not plausible, but you might find a scenario where inland transport nodes are dominated by a specific entity. So I'm also recommending that that infrastructure also be included in this definition. So with regard to the purpose of the act, here, you know, there are a couple of minor inclusions that I would like to propose. So section 31B, I'm proposing that in addition to the current statement, we add, you know, the transport interchange or terminal, but preferably a transport interchange, so that it can cover other types of transportation nodes. If you see the current terminology, it just says through ports or through airports or ports, and but that is that immediately excludes intermodal freight transport nodes, and it also excludes intermodal public transport facilities, specifically transport interchanges. So I'm proposing that that is included. In terms of 4.2, you know, the word is here again where, you know, the minister in consultation with the regulator by notice in the Gazette may declare that the Act applies to any market. Here I'm proposing that again we substitute the term market with transport market, so that we are very clear about what we are really talking about and not just the general discourse. And 4.2a, the point around, you know, the 70% of market control is a bit complex. But what I will say, given the time, is that there is a need to clarify how the 70% threshold was determined. And this is why a discussion document was necessary. But also, there is also a need to clarify issues around the single operator. Because, for example, in South Africa, we have a road freight industry that dominates the freight transport market. And then at the same time, we want to shift goods from road to rail and improve the market share of rail freight transport. Now, if that is the ambitions that we have, then it is not just about a single operator. It might actually be about specific types of transport modes. So the use of the term single operator, you know, might limit the potential for various types of intervention. You see that, for example, again in the minibus taxi industry, about multiple individual operators who are, you know, participating in the market, but they dominate the public transport industry. And it's quite interesting in terms of their dominance, but you know it's not clear how this kind of bill will actually interact with them. Same thing would apply, for instance, again with other sectors. But the determination of the threshold is really really important, because other stakeholders might interpret the threshold in terms of dominance by tons, by ton kilometers, some by revenue. And so the clarity is really, really, really crucial in terms of market control or market dominance. Then when we talk about, you know, these issues around the preconditions for efficiency and cost effectiveness, this is 4.2b, you know, the term around preconditions is extremely important. And one of the issues here is that in the impact assessment, the DOT makes it very clear that they are concerned about the big risk of losing the cross subsidization function within the Transnet. And what we know is that Transnet is operating under the theme old economics, which are dependent on cross subsidization. But in the literature, what we see is that there's something called a universal service obligation, or a service obligation in general. And we might have to account for that, because, for example, if you look at PRASA, it has a service obligation in terms of serving the public and providing an essential transport service that is affordable for all. So it's got a much broader objective, a coverage objective, and therefore it has a service objective in terms of its developmental goals. So the preconditions for efficiency, service obligations, service levels and service conditions, and cost effectiveness, you know, should be the terminology that that we use to determine whether, you know, these types of, whether this entity should be regulated or not, or whether this market should be regulated or not. And furthermore, it also applies in the context of the taxi industry and the meter taxi industry and the likes. You know, the service conditions have not been outlined. What we know is that there are conditions in terms of market entry and practice, but there are no clear service conditions that have been outlined there, especially, and you see when you move towards price regulation, these service conditions become an essential element to the price regulatory model and framework, specifically because they contribute to the effort. Then again, 4.3, I'm also here saying that we need to add service obligations so that we can account for, you know, the public nature of some of the services that will be provided. And especially given that we also want to empower small and medium enterprises and provide affordable and accessible integrated transport. So in section 4, 5B and 10A, you know, here I'm only proposing that we indicate the minimum time. We just say at least 30 days to respond to a notice, at least. You know, I'm not saying that 30 days be the fixed number, but I'm proposing that we either add 30 days or we include a new subsection that basically argues that, at least 30 days be given to respond to any of these kinds of issues. This will help to avoid any abnormal decisions being made without a proper and effective consultation. This is the last section with regard to my comments. In terms of price regulation, I didn't want to go overboard with regard to these issues, but what I would say is that for 11.2b, the terminology is that a limit to the total amount of revenue it may raise from the facilities and services offered by it. And this is with regard to the regulator. This is with regard to the entities involved. And you know, my concern is that the wording revenue, doesn't necessarily interact with gross value added. It doesn't necessarily interact with externalities like CO2 emissions, noise pollution, impact on communities, fatalities or, accidents or risks that are part and parcel of some transport interventions and transport modes and their activities. So my recommendation is that we also include externalities, and also so that we can follow through on the Paris Agreement in terms of, our focus as a country to move towards a more low carbon society. And when we start including this type of language to our policies, then we'll be in a position where we start to reflect and provide policy certainty about the direction that we're trying to go. In terms of 11.3, each regulatory entity should be submitting a proposal. The position is a bit complex. Because on one hand, I do favor this approach, but at the same time, we must be aware that there is a potential for bias, there are risks for underreporting, and there are also challenges with regard to incentivization. So it is really crucial that anyone who's drafting and reflecting on the bill spend some time reflecting on this issue. And in terms of 11.4b, Roman numeral 3, the terminology is that the opportunity cost of capital, including the average rate of return on other domestic or international facilities or services having similar or comparable risks. This is with regard to some of the factors that need to be accounted for. I would propose that we include also the opportunity cost of public funds and be very clear about that, because in some instances there might be scenarios where the entities involved might have to be making decisions between a public or private sector type of intervention. That depends on how long we think this policy will survive. Then in terms of 11.10a, with regard to the calculation of the impact of proposed price control deviation on the entity's revenues, costs and profitability. My recommendation in this regard is that it is important to include the service level implications. Because if we are already saying that the regulator might be able to impose certain service requirements, then the impacts of changes in price control interventions might in fact impact on the service provision or the service or the company or the entity's ability to meet the service requirements. That or the service levels that have been agreed upon. And to close off here, lastly, set service standards in respect of any activity that is subject to price control. And again, here I'm proposing that we will need techniques and tools and approaches and of course additional regulations that basically outline how this will be determined. And then again, it's also an opportunity for a discussion document. So this is a duplication. With regard to the economic regulator, the key issue here for 38C is that we need to, as much as you know, the regulator is focused on facilitating competition, I'm proposing that in line with the white paper on national transport policy, we also facilitate complementarity, which means integration of various transportation modes. So facilitating complementarity, competition, where possible, and implementing regulations is the language that I think would be more appropriate, because you want these entities to be able to work together and not always to be in competition. So there must be a deep degree of complementarity as well. It must be clear in that regard. And in terms of determining the price controls for transport facilities and services in accordance to Part A of Chapter 3, the request is that we need the techniques. So we need these guidelines. We need subsequent regulations or another, again, discussion document if this bill does not get through, that outlines the specific approaches and methods that will be used to do what the regulator is intends to do. And in that regard, thank you so much, Kilebohela Nakwalena. I really appreciate the opportunity to share. It's a real honor to finally present to you, Honorable Chairperson, and the committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ufenze Hlulani Mokoena. As I promised you, I'll never fail you that after your presentation, we will prove to you that we're listening to you. And the one way of proving to you is to ask and comment. I'm going to open the floor for people to talk to you. But let me say right from the onset, we appreciate you taking time from your schedule to come and address us on this issue or the bill. Let me allow my honorable members of this transport committee to have their say. Maybe I should start with Honorable May. Honorable May, are you there? You want to say something?
Yes, Chairperson.
You are number one. You are number one. Let me take Dade Makosidi Chabangu, Ditabe Mo Kwa Kwanda De Unaliso Watangisbua.
Allah, Allah. Yes, sir.
Let me see hands after the two honorable members. Honorable Hansinger, do we have any other hand? Okay. Honorable Figile or Honorable Ketamabal and Honorable Isaac Sihlulo, I can see why. Okay. Akbar Liede Pitme.
Thank you, Chairperson. As I've said from a previous speaker, thank you. And I like to listen to the academics. I know they're clever guys. Thank you very much.
You see? Yeah, no. Thank you very much, honorable member. Let's get Ntate Chabangu. Ntate Chabangu.
Yeah, Chairperson. In Sesotho, it is said that le potla potla le ja pudi le sisitheo le ja kgomo. That is why we speak at the back. Let me also reiterate the fact that the presentation by Ntate Ofentse was loud and clear. Chairperson, can you hear me?
Go, Mamedumrena.
I'm saying, let me also reiterate the fact that the presentation by Ntate Ofentse Mokoena was loud and clear. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
You spoke of bus, taxi, and taxis. The bus and taxis, Mr. Ofentse, are not directly involved, and though they deal directly with the municipalities and local government, they also deal with directly with the poor of the poorest citizens, the vulnerable. How best could we redirect this bill to deal with the above mentioned and be an industry of all South Africans, not only the blacks? The second question is with regard to Municipal Transportation Regulating Authority. I would like to know as to whether metros like Bloemfontein or Mangaung, not in line with the above mentioned, because unlike other big metros, the municipality does not have their own transport, like your Rea Vaya, My City, and so forth. How best can you lay a helping hand with regard to the establishment of the transportation for the municipalities like Mangaung, and also to create police, because metro police, because that is in itself is job creation. Thank you, sir.
Honorable Hun Singer.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, Mr. Mokoena. Is it Mr. Mokoena or is it Dr. Mokoena?
It's Mr. Thank you.
All right, I'm sure you'll progress in due time towards doctorship and professorship. Thank you for your presentation, and thank you for the particular insights that you provided with an overall perspective. Also discussing the regulatory model as a theory and academic analysis, not comparing it to any other alternatives. But certainly within a academic framework. You mentioned particular structural issues, and you referred to it that the regulator would have a particular relevance in addressing parts of transport versus the entire transport sector. How do you see this division in terms of design? That in relation with your remark a little bit further on, where you said it would have relevance in a early stage, as you put it, but it might have more relevance later on, given that it would contribute to development, from where we started in 94 and how we progress forward. You also made a particular remark where you said that it might be premature for the broader economic sector. If you could just elaborate on that. Would you say that the public benefit is of substantial consideration within that framework and within the role as envisaged by the regulator? versus the benefits that it could have for the state versus the necessity to encourage private sector involvement, but then also other sectors of public sector management and involvement. And in that regard, I would want to hear your ideas about access agreements and opening up state infrastructure and an approach of separation of infrastructure and operation, particularly in rail. Lastly, I would like to hear your further thinking around what you acknowledged in, I think it was section 11, sub 3, where you referred to underperformance, that there's room for underperformance in order to justify levels of support. If you could expand and share with us your thinking around that particular point. Thank you, Chairperson, and thanks again, Mr. Mokoena.
Siyabulela kakhulu, Honorable Hansinger. Which hand have I not touched all of them? Is there anybody I've jumped? Nobody. Yeah, I can see I've jumped somebody. Mkhayesh.
No, thank you so much.
You know, are you going to join us here?
No, kate tla ga go tshe if ha o bona go le botlhoka gore re bue Setswana, we may very well do so. I don't have a problem. No, re ke leboge modula setulo, ke leboge Rre Mokoena ka presentation ya gagwe. But certainly for the courtesy of other members, I suppose it would be only fair if I had engaged him in a manner in which the Honorable Hunsinger and Honorable May also be able to understand. But mine is, I suppose it's a general remark and question that would to a certain extent require a yes or no. But given the current legislative and regulatory framework in terms of transport, I suppose the question would be, given the recommendations that have been given by Mr. Mokoena, would be, do we in essence essentially need this bill? Do we in essence need this regulatory bill? And, it would be interesting to find out, because there's quite a number of comments as it relates to recommendations that have been made. And I'm asking this question on the basis of the previous presentation that we've had. And I strongly want to hear what Mokoena's views are. Mr. Mokoena's views are, pardon me, Chair, in that regard. Thank you.
Except to say he's also your homeboy.
Well, he's not my homeboy. He's from Garankuwa. He just happens to work at my alumni university, but in Mafikeng. Whereas I studied in Portsmouth.
Okay. No, that's fine. Thank you, Honorable Member. And that I'm going.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. And also from honorable members, these are very interesting questions. Let me start with Honorable Chabang's question, and I'm just going to share the screen again so that I can also just make sure that the answers are in line with what I have presented. So, it's good. The question is really interesting, because it targets number one, that how do we redirect the bill to cover all of South Africa and specifically transport modes and services that serve the vulnerable of the vulnerable, and secondly how do we lay a helping hand in for establishing a not only transport authorities, but also transport companies or entities, and the underlying provision of law enforcement officials, particularly, I think it's traffic, maybe Honorable Chabang will clarify on this, and subsequent job creation. So I'm using this diagram here to illustrate my response. The bill taps into so many different elements of the transport environment. And the main issue is that if you are making a transport plan, your transport plan is informed by your integrated development plan. And that comes from, you know, ward councillors, it has inputs from stakeholders and other engagements. But the transport plan is also a product of your spatial development framework, and it is also a product of engagements and primary data collection with the transport operators in your market, freight and passenger. So in areas where you have a situation that there's a lot of railway operations, there's also bus operations, and there's also minibus taxis, of course, you'll have a comprehensive transport plan. And in that instance, there will be significant strategies that are produced. But now, the bill, the way it's structured, is that it taps into the entities within the market, but its relationship with the authorities that are responsible for translating the transport plans into inputs for the integrated development plan, and therefore the service delivery budget on one hand, but also the pricing of services in the local area. So the number of vehicles in a route for taxis, the rationalization of buses, all of that information is inside the transport plan. So the bill, the connection between the bill and the existing transport policy environment can easily be reconnected if we reintroduce the previous Chapter 2, Section 5, that basically highlights this the coordination and cooperation between the provinces and municipalities with regard to the bill, because the transport authorities are well on their way. With regard to enabling the implementation of transport authorities or the formulation of transport authorities, you know, when you want to provide a bus transport or set up a bus transport entity, on one hand, you might want to have it as a, you know, privately structured entity through a competitive tendering process or a transport operating company, or you can structure it similarly to the way the BRTs were structured, where you're converting existing minibus taxi operators or routes into a transport operating company. But, you know, the conversion takes time, but introducing new services is also politically risky. So for municipalities to really get this right, they need a transport authority that will then navigate the process and will have the right instruments and people to actually take this forward. And currently, given the structure of this bill and given the way in which we're talking about transport at the moment, there is a lot of room for that. And in terms of absorbing the function of law enforcement, it is possible. According to the Road Traffic Management Corporation Act, it's really plausible to bring in those functions. To Honorable Hunsinger, very complex question, and I will take it to the relevant slide. You know, the question is largely around number one on the structural issues. So South Africa, we've been using the word structural issues, I think, since about 99 or yeah, I think the early 90s. We've been using the term structural issues, and we use the language to justify the concessions that have seen us bring in things like your TREC, your N3TC, your Bakwena, and other concessions. And it was largely so that we can basically absorb the efficiencies and remove the responsibility of actually administering and operating the road infrastructure, remove it and pass it on to the private sector. But we're absorbing the efficiencies as a country. We're absorbing the returns on that investment. Now, the current structural issues are usually associated with the fact that there's limited access to railways, railway infrastructure in particular. And this is a very problematic conversation, but what is clear is that what the last thing that you want in an economy that might be moving towards a growth trajectory is a scenario where there is it's not liberalized, meaning there is no option for private sector to actually participate if and when they want to, based on an access fee. So what you try to create is a situation where the option is available. It doesn't mean that private sector will participate. No, no. It just means that the option is there. And it's outside of a joint venture agreement as per the Legal Succession Act. So that is what I mean in terms of addressing the structural issues embedded in that. And if you have a monopoly running the entire work stream, then you have a problem, because what you see in the port regulators' reports as well is that we have significantly higher logistics costs, and there's also a disconnection between our industrial objectives and also our transportation objectives, and that culminates itself in the structure of our port tariffs. So in terms of the scenario, in terms of the scenarios, just to give you an idea of why I argued that it might be a little bit premature, if you look at the bill at the moment, it is, so it's much easier to focus on regulation of rail transport. Because then it will be specifically focused on a specific transport mode and a specific transport industry. That way the complexity of the problem is reduced and becomes a little bit more manageable. And then the regulator can learn from what it experiences in the rail transport sector and then expand forward into other industries. But now, when we move towards focusing on network industries as per the National Treasury's report or position paper, you know, it becomes a little bit more difficult, because now we're absorbing more modes or more industries in the transport sector, but specifically the ones that are network-based. So it does not include, for now, it does not include, you know, other industries that are, you know, downward in the value chain in terms of public transport, specifically minibus taxis, meter taxis, ride hailing, ride sharing type technologies. Doesn't include them, but it only includes strategic assets specifically to address the economic inefficiencies that we have from a broader performance perspective. And it would also produce things like intermodal interchanges and other things. But that is really, if you want to fast track the return on investment, specifically for the broader public in terms of economic efficiency, for the state, it would largely create a degree of legitimacy for economic regulation. And for the private sector, it will open up much greater opportunities for participation. But in terms of the impact on, you know, public service, it requires a new spectrum of competency, and this is in line with the RDP. You know, the principles of the reconstruction and development plan are very clear on the development of state capacity, and it's very clear on people. You know, it's a people-centered development trajectory, which is, you know, one of the foundation stones that we have, and, you know, following the second scenarios is going to require the deeper relationships between various parts of the transportation sector, and that's going to be key. And so the last scenario is the one where I'll talk a little bit about access agreements and issues around separation of operations and infrastructure. So in the last scenario, we're looking at a situation where we have an all-inclusive policy. To do this requires a lot of preliminary work, and it requires significant research and evidence to develop the methodologies. And in this format, you might want to have a regulator or an equivalent entity first, if not an agency within the DOT largely, that focuses on trying to develop the right kinds of tools and measures and instruments to inform the legislation, to inform a policy that covers all of these sectors. But we already have the first two scenarios at our disposal. But when we go deeper into these issues, it becomes complex. So as an example, in terms of access agreement, you know, to do this in a broad policy framework will require, you know, engagements with a much broader array of stakeholders. For example, for long distance bus transport, you know, the excess price regime will have to be restructured and reviewed. And a lot of engagement will have to take place about the cost profile, the unit returns associated with the use of that infrastructure, and then how that informs, you know, how that informs the structure of the excess charge. Simultaneously, from a state perspective, excess pricing might be an attractive option because for some officials, it will be interesting to absorb that revenue and use it for, you know, for other activities. So it will require some ring fencing on one hand, but on the other hand, it can also, if not done properly, it can also distort markets. And if it's, for example, used to substitute cost subsidization, then it creates new problems as well. So, you know, access agreements are extremely complex. They also deal with issues around allocation risks and so on. So we need to tread very, very lightly on them. And this leads me to your last question on 11.3, on a room for underperformance and or underreporting. So what we see in the literature is that information is very expensive, especially when you're going to look for it from specific entities. We've seen with the Stainoff, we've seen with the various other entities that it is very plausible that companies and entities that we want to regulate might choose to underreport, and that's a problem. But now underperformance will be subject to the type of regulatory regime that's adopted. For example, if we set a price cap, for instance, we might be pushing the entities to reduce their service levels, so not perform as well as they should, so that they can increase their margins because their cost is lower. You know, and then on the other hand, you might be in a situation where they will be reporting that information, but they won't be, they'll be reporting accurately, but they'll be performing below their ability or below their capacity, meaning they won't be exerting the amount of effort that you would want as an economic regulator. So when they submit their proposals for intervention or price reforms, et cetera, at face value, you know, as an analyst, you think, well, this is fine, you know, they've been performing in this particular kind of way. But whereas in terms of their organization and their capacity or ability to perform, they're actually underperforming on purpose. And that is a real big problem when it comes to economic regulation. And the wording that we use is asymmetric information. So you don't have the same type of information on both sides. Of you know, the regulator can't see what the entity is actually doing in reality, and that creates an imbalance in terms of information. To go to Honorable Siotolo's question around whether we need this bill, specifically based on the previous presentations. What I will say is that it's not my place to articulate whether this bill is necessary or unnecessary, but it is my place to outline that the incentives for having a bill like this are very high, specifically with regard to rail transport and policy certainty from a rail transport infrastructure investment perspective, especially when you look at the African Union Agenda 2063 and the agenda around advancing the African Transport Network investment program. So we are at a point where there's a lot of emphasis that we need to open up the railway market, but also enable the implementation or at least the implementation of the Luxembourg Rail Protocol that will allow and enable leasing companies and rail leasing companies to actually participate in the African market. So in that regard, you know, the incentive is extremely high for railway transport. But on the far end of the extreme, there are some serious risks, especially for the vulnerable of the vulnerable. If we don't specify the bill properly in terms of what and who it's focused on, then the bill will not see the results that it's looking forward to seeing, and that is where the bill will actually be considered null and void, because it's so broad in scope that implementation becomes exceptionally difficult. So as honorable members, the reason why I was making this presentation was just to show the extremes and leave the decision up to you and your constituency. Thank you so much for the questions. I hope I have answered them.
No, thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Mkwena. Let me take this opportunity then to say thank you to you for having taken time to prepare thoroughly, as you have done, and to come and present to us. We have heard you. Please don't lose track of this bill as we move forward, because we really want a situation where this bill will be informed by and largely by the views of people like you. Otherwise, thank you very much, Mrenaka. Reserule buile, khabane.
Folebohanna, disalempila, di tlogomile.
Ah, ke weta. Ikabantse di maski jwale. Rose mumu na uske wa ri ukala bhloko Mrenaka. Thank you, Dad. Honorable members, we have now heard the Honorable Mkwena. Can we move forward and get other stakeholders? The last presentation will be by Free Market Foundation. Do we have somebody here? Free Market.
Chair, I don't see Mr. Moore online. I've sent an email because I've asked all the presenters to be earlier than the allocated time. His slot was for 11:45, but I've asked the presenters to come at least 30 minutes to an hour earlier, just in case the previous presenter finish ahead of time. I don't see him. I've asked his colleagues at the organization to just check on his whereabouts so that we can know whether they are still coming.
Okay. That's okay, Valerie. I guess you are saying I must practice patience.
Okay, I've just got an email from him now. I'm going to ask him to join if the committee maybe wants to take a comfort break while we're connecting him.
Comfort break. Okay, 2 minutes, 2 minutes stretch, let's say 5 minutes stretch. Honorable members, please.
So we should be starting in the next minute. Ms. Priscilla Schlati is now sending the presentation to members.
Our screens will show. It will say yes. Now sharing.
Yeah. Oh, welcome, Mr. Moore. I'm connecting you to our screen now. So if you're ready, you can upload your presentation to start. Mr. Moore?
Tell him to unmute.
Mr. Moore, if you unmute yourself, you are online now. If you're ready to start the presentation, you can just give me an idea.
Mr. Gary Moore.
No.
Welcome, Mr. Moore. We can see you on screen.
I must try to contact you again. There.
We can see you.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can
hear you. Yes, we can hear you.
Excellent.
Excellent.
Apologies for the delay. I thank all the members of the committee for this opportunity, and I sincerely regret the delay.
Okay. No, that's okay. That's okay. We are very patient. It's on a Wednesday. Let me just check whether my honorable members are here. I can see they are connected.
I can see Mr. Hunziger and Mr. Mabena, and perhaps Racha Harichara.
Yeah, no, it's okay. I've seen them. Let me allow you an opportunity, Mr. Gary Moore. You are representing Free Market,
the Free Market Foundation.
Yes. No, let me give you an opportunity to address the honorable members. That's how we are referred to in Parliament in a session.
Thank you very much, honorable members. For this opportunity to present us the Free Market Foundation submission to the Portfolio Committee on Transport about the Economic Regulation of Transport Bill No. 1 of 2020. The Free Market Foundation is an independent public benefit organization founded in 1975 to promote and foster an open society, the rule of law, personal liberty, and economic and press freedom. And its rule of law project is a Free Market Foundation initiative dedicated to giving substance to the National Constitution's provision, which provides for supremacy of the Constitution and the rule of law. Should I just proceed, Mr. Zoni?
Sir, the platform is yours.
Thank you, sir. Honorable members, the bill as a whole will impose undue restrictions on the transportation sector, and the Free Market Foundation submits that the bill should be withdrawn in its entirety. The memorandum on the objects of the bill in paragraph 1.1 points out that preconditions for efficiency and cost effectiveness do not exist in the transportation sector. And in particular, transport is dominated by large state-owned companies who have a very high degree of market power over either the infrastructure or services which they operate. And our submission, and I believe this is not in our written document, but I make it very clearly now, that large state-owned transportation companies should be broken up and privatized. Shall I proceed?
We are listening attentively, sir. Proceed until you are finished.
Very flattering. Thank you very much. Honorable members, clause 4.4 brackets, 2 brackets, little a of the bill says that the minister may declare that the act applies to any market in the transport sector if the minister has determined that a single operator controls more than 70% of the market. We submit that this 70% threshold is arbitrary, and there's no reason why it should be 70% and not another value, such as, say, 1% or 99%. Clause 4, brackets 2, brackets little b, states that the minister may declare that the Act applies to any market in the transport sector if the minister has determined that the preconditions for efficiency and cost effectiveness do not exist in the market. But the clause doesn't define what might constitute preconditions for efficiency and cost effectiveness. As I say, the memo on the objects of the bill says flatly that the preconditions for efficiency and cost effectiveness do not exist in the transport sector because it's dominated by large state-owned companies. I proceed. Clause 4 brackets little a states that when making such a determination, that the Act applies to any market in the transport sector, the regulator says here, should that not be the minister? Is there not an error there? Must have found that at least one firm operating in the market has market power, defined as power of the of an entity to control prices or exclude competition, or to an appreciable extent behave independently of its competitors, customers, and suppliers. We say that every firm in every market, in every economy, in throughout the world has power to control prices to some extent, because perfect competition does not exist in the real world. Every firm has power to exclude competition to some extent, simply because purchasing or supplying resources excludes other firms from doing so, if only temporarily. Market entities never behave independently of their competitors, customers, or suppliers. So these assumptions behind the definition of market power are based on misunderstanding of the reality of markets. I proceed. Clause 4(b) states that when making such a determination, the regulator, or perhaps the minister it should be, must alternatively have found that a facility or resource in the market is an essential facility, which clause 1 defines as a facility or resource that cannot reasonably be duplicated and without access to which competitors cannot reasonably provide goods or services to their customers. These criteria that essential facility is a facility or resource that cannot reasonably be duplicated and without access to which competitors cannot reasonably provide goods or services to their customers of somewhat vague and undefined. We say clause 4(7) states that the minister may grant an exemption from the application of the Act to any market, entity, facility or service if satisfied that it does not have a material effect on competitive conditions or power to control prices, exclude competition or behave independently. And we say, as mentioned, every firm has power to control prices to some extent and to exclude competition to some extent. And market entities never behave independently of their competitors, customers or suppliers. So this really means that the minister can never grant an exemption. I will be brief and I will just go straight to clause 11, which will be the final one of my presentation tonight. I know you have had an intensive day, honorable members. I will try to restrict myself to the bare bones relevant. So clause 11 authorizes the control of prices that can be charged by regulated entities for the use of access to its assets, facilities, or services. I submit that large state-owned companies who dominate transportation and have a very high degree of market power over the infrastructural services they privatize should be broken up. They operate should be broken up and privatized. The need for price controls will then fall away. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, honorable members.
Mr. Gary Moore, what I did not say to you, sir, and I'm sorry I did not say that after every presentation, we ensure that we give you a proof that we're listening to you. And that proof comes as a way of comments and clarity seeking questions. we are going to request you to be so generous to listen to us as we have listened to you, and respond where you can respond after this exercise. Let me see how many members wants to engage with you. Honorable Pete May, are you available?
Yes, Chairperson.
You are number one. Khabane, Dade Makosena, Uteng?
Not this time.
Thank you very much. Let me see hands, honorable members. Baba Keta Mabala. Okay, we only have two hands. Thank you very much. Latons Khan Menier.
What's the hand figure?
Honorable Hansinger. Honorable May.
Thank you, Chairperson. As Mr. Moore said, transport in South Africa is dominated by large state companies. What is the chance that the private sector will invest in transport business, seeing that the SOEs are all bankrupt? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable May. Mondis.
First of all, we must thank Mr. Moore because he takes his time to come and present his opinion and his view on us. But I have only one question that I want to understand from him. When he says the bill should be withdrawn in its entity, actually it should be withdrawn. What is the reason behind that one? Why? How did this understand the bill and how, why did you want the bill to be withdrawn? Thank you very much, Chairperson.
In short, okay. Because there are a lot of these discretions, honourable members, there are a lot of discretions conferred on the minister or the regulator to impose restrictions in terms of the bill, often vague and undefined discretions, and the bill does not really improve the economic situation in the transport sector, which would be vastly improved by the privatization of large companies.
Thank you.
Be better on balance were the bill simply to be withdrawn.
Okay. Let's take Honorable Chris Hunsinger and take Honorable Tamsanga, then we'll give back to you, sir, to respond.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, Mr. Moore, for your submission, also for sharing your ideas and representing the Free Market Foundation eloquently. Mr. Moore, the Economic Regulation of Transport Bill expresses its intention to regulate transport, but then particularly the economic functioning of transport over a vast scope of modes, which includes passenger rail. And whereas it's well known that you hardly have a privatized passenger rail system in the world, which functions in private ownership. Are you suggesting that in its current form and with our current economy that passenger rail should be privatized in South Africa? Could you make notes of my questions and reply all of them at the end, please?
Very well. Also, rail privatized? Yes.
Also, that freight rail, you know, given the fact that we only have basically one entity in the form of Transnet, and cargo related to that with container, that should be privatized. Then I would also, in light of that, would like to explore your thinking around the subsidy scheme which we currently have, where passenger trips in buses are subsidized, where passenger trips in Shosholoza Mail are subsidized, with regards to your thinking to privatize those. Then I would also like to explore your thinking around the Competition Commission and its functioning and its role within the current environment, but with a restricted scope and the potential which this bill might have to fill the gap, not just in price regulation, but also in participation regulation and also coordination. I'll stick to those questions. Thank you, Mr. Moon. Thanks again for taking time in analyzing this bill and approaching us with your particular views. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hansinger, those are good questions. Sorry, Mr. Zwani.
Yeah, let's take the last one, then you'll answer everything.
The last one to do with the Competition Commission.
No, let's take the last speaker. We still have the last honorable member to ask questions, then we'll answer all the questions. Thank you very much for understanding, sir. Mhlonishwa baba uma pena indoda yangakithi.
Ngithokoze hlalo, ngithokoze for ithuba, ngithokoze ubaba uMo for the presentation. I see which is very energetic and is very spirited this morning. I want to get done with the questions and comments from honorable members as soon as possible. Look, I think in essence, the Free Market Foundation obviously is a proponent of the forces of demand and supply dictating the market trends and terms in terms of the economy of South Africa. And obviously, the principle is one that he personally aligned to. I truly do believe that the forces of demand and supply should dictate terms in terms of the market and what is to be done and what is to be produced. However, in this case, Mr. Moyer is saying that in the world there's no perfect competition. You're quite right. Absolutely correct. There's no perfect competition in any market. However, that is why in South Africa we have the Competition Commission. And in essence, it was established exclusively with an understanding and appreciation that in the world there is no perfect competition, that companies and entities in their nature are driven by profit and in their nature are driven by revenue. And therefore, as such, unscrupulous and anti-competitive behavior exists within companies, within those companies. However, in here, you made a specific reference to the 70% dominance of a single player in any market, in any sector where the minister can come and have an intervention. And we are saying that why should the figure not be 1%? Why should the figure not be 30%? Look, for instance, in terms of freight rail in South Africa, the movement of goods, cargo, and especially by rail, that is dominated by one player and is a state entity and is dominated by Transnet. The bill seems to say that there should be access agreements that needs to be in place, which will also ensure that there are other players, private players, which can come in and also render services in that space, in that sector. It's just that in this case, should there be a 70% dominance by a single player within a specific sector? Therefore, there is reasonable motivation for intervention. Now, in terms of, for instance, let's look at the minibus taxis in South Africa are not subsidized. And in order for you, and you know, with the competition in place during the COVID-19 pandemic, when it started, taxis increase their pricing by 100%. They said either we increase by 100% or we go back to 100% capacity loading. And there was nothing that anyone could do about it. The minister only had a function to mediate and also was at the mercy of the taxi industry. And also, remember, the minibus taxis, the passengers in minibus taxis are not subsidized as compared to passengers in rail and passengers in bus trips, which are subsidized. Now, the also, in order for us to conclude access agreements also, it also speaks to underutilized facilities and infrastructure, which might be sitting there in decay. If there is what the bill seeks to achieve, and when the bill is enacted, don't you think that would come in handy and come in positively to ensure that those that infrastructure and facilities which are underutilized, access agreements can be concluded, and then those can that's be commissioned, and they can come on instead of them wasting away as they are. Thank you so much, Chairperson.
Thank you so much, Baba Mapena. Mr. Gary?
Thank you, Mr. Zwani. If I may, I'm actually going to answer Mr. Mabena's first. I didn't take a note because I listened carefully so I could get the point. Yes, I understand it's a very vexed, it's a challenging sector, transportation, to attempt to regulate, particularly as regards price. And it is still so that in a market, different carriers will charge different prices, and it's not always up to the supplier of the service to dictate prices to passengers or to owners of goods who want them shipped, particularly if there's competition in the market. And yes, I am saying, Mr. Hamsinger, that rail should be privatized. As far as the carriages, the rails are concerned, that is one thing, but there could be competing train services on the rails, is really what the Free Market Foundation believes. And it's unequal to subsidize one form of road transport and not others. And in the long run, it leads to, it doesn't lead to efficiency or an effective market and or consumer choice. The best consumer choice is where without the distortions of one sector or one supplier or one group of suppliers being subsidized and not others, there's true competition among them, and the commuters can properly choose which is in fact the cheaper. As to the role of the Competition Commission, many of the clauses in the bill seems to be rather similar to what is found in the Competition Act, and it seems to be an unnecessary duplication of roles. You have a general competition regulator, and then there's the special one for transport. Mrs. Rani, I think that's all I can say.
Okay. No, thanks very much. Thanks for coming on behalf of your foundation to send our appreciation that you took time to come and address us on this bill. We have heard you. Please do not lose track of this bill because we actually want to consult as
Say again, Mr. Zwani. Please do not lose track of the bill. We won't. You said you want to consult.
So I think Mr. Zwani's network connectivity is frozen, Mr. Moore. So
yes, it does seem that way.
We should give him.
If he doesn't come back, I ask you to convey to him my thanks for this opportunity. And we are the Free Market Foundation are available to express their views in much more detail. And I want to thank the members of the committee for staying as long as they have, because I understand I was the last speaker and I could have come on earlier.
Also, Mr. Moore, you did submit a very extensive document in respect of your comments up until, I think, clause 62. So I will also make that known to the chairperson in that regard.
Oh, the written submissions?
Correct.
Yes, I also have a very brief outline of what I have said today, as a 6 pages, short and sweet, which I can also convey to Ms. Carlson.
Thank you. Over to you, Valerie.
The chairperson is in fear the way the network is.
It seems that chairperson is... Okay, I'm going to take this call from chair now, and then I'll get back to the committee.
I think we should proceed with the minutes and appoint an acting chairperson so that we can proceed, guys. Thank you.
Shall I withdraw from the meeting then?
I was doing a very good job there.
Yes, I appreciate it. Proceed.
Members, chairperson got disconnected. He will be rechecking in the next minute or so.
Mr. Moore, yes, to answer your question, yes. Thank you very much for presenting. You can indeed leave the meeting now.
Thank you for this opportunity, Mr. Moben.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Khutkhan. Mr. Gary.
He's gone.
Thank you, Mr. No. I say good day. Good night.
Thank you. Thank you, sir. Thank you.
You're free today.
Honorable members, I'm sorry I lost a bit of connection. We're done with the presentations today. We're only left with one issue that... was raised to with me earlier today and by Advocate Nell. This issue concerns the terms of reference. There's an issue that she wants to raise, and I think I want to give her that opportunity to raise that matter so that we can deal with it. And finish with it. Advocate.
Thank you, Chair. Following the adoption or approval by members of the draft terms of reference and the request just to ensure that we include in the scope of the work the consideration of other illegal vehicle conversions, I've made those amendments to the draft terms. What I'm just requesting through chairperson is if Mr. Hunsinger can just assist us to draft a paragraph on these other vehicle conversions, because he does have quite a bit more information on it than I myself do. It will assist us just to add it as a paragraph, because if members do refer back to the draft that we sent out earlier, there is a specific paragraph on the public protector's report and the findings in there, as well as the investigation. We need to have a similar one on these other types of vehicle conversions, just to include it in there. And then I've also just spoken and had a chat with our supervisor. Members will see the terms of reference is phrased and the specific phrasing in there is used and referred to the committee's oversight powers and mandate. instead of referring to the work of the subcommittee as an investigation or an inquiry. We do this because investigations and inquiries are normally referred to committees by the House, but nothing stops the committee from looking into any matter under its oversight mandate. The investigations and inquiries take on a whole different form and life of themselves, where you need evidence leaders and quite a lot more assistance in committee support. But for us to process the current matters before us, just focusing on it as a consideration by the committee under its oversight functions, we shouldn't have a problem with needing to have all the additional assistance. I'm just raising this because a lot of the members referred to the work of the committee yesterday as an investigation or an inquiry. So we just need to make sure that we use the correct wording in the terms of reference and in the reference to the work, so that we are not outside of the scope of the work that the committee can perform, and so that we have sufficient support staff and the frame set out for that. If we can get the paragraph from Mr. Hunsinger, and we can finalize that term of reference, it will assist us to also then process it further to do the setting of the dates and identify all our support staff and the needs of the subcommittee. Thank you, Chair.
Honorable members, Honorable Hunsinger.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, indeed, I will assist in helping to draft that paragraph. My question upon the submission of Advocate Nell to rather describe the functioning of the subcommittee as oversight in role and function rather than investigate. My question would be whether under oversight we can include having interviews, and whether those interviews would have a particular and same status as when we would have done this under investigate. The National Assembly rules allow subcommittees to have investigations. Oversight is a general function, but specifically in this clause that we are that we use for requesting this power, investigation was used. But my question then is whether we can interview and submit formal evidence to the principal committee under the oversight function.
Yes, Advocate.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I specifically also spoke with the supervisor regarding this, because the rules are the procedural aspects. And the NA Rule 167, which is the general powers, do still allow the committee and the subcommittee to summon and call any person to appear before it, receive any representations, and can hear oral evidence on those matters before the committee. It's just that you won't need to have a formal person there, as some of the other committees or specific committees set up by the NA would require to have an evidence leader. In this instance, we can consider all the evidence that are presented. We just don't have to have a focus on almost a court-like inquisitorial consideration. And the recommendations will be in line with what the committee as the portfolio committee can also request. As we've done in some of our BRRRs, we've made recommendations to the Minister of Finance. Should it come out in this look, if we look at the alleged ambulance conversions, we could then also look at the possibility of including a recommendation or a proposal to the Portfolio Committee on Health to perhaps investigate further into those aspects. Maybe it could be a procurement issue by the Department of Health, which we'll always also have in the back of our mind. Similarly to when we look at the public protectors aspects and areas that will affect the Department of Trade and Industry and Competition, We will have to look at the wording of the recommendations at that point, but Mr. Hunsinger, nothing prevents us from subpoenaing, calling witnesses, and getting evidence.
Honorable Hunsinger.
Thank you, Chairperson. I accept and I'm happy with what was said. Thank you, Advocate Nell. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I think let's deal with that and finalize in our next meeting. Let me take this opportunity and use the power that you have borrowed me as the portfolio committee to take this meeting into its logical end. But before I do that, let me acknowledge that I was inspired this morning by a young growing man, Honorable Mapena, having his jacket on. So he made me to go and to rush and have my jacket on, and I really want to thank him. I can see he's maturing with time. Otherwise, honorable members, we are going to see each other on Friday. Thank you very much. Have a fruitful day. We meet in plenary. Thank you.
What are you saying about Mr. McDonald, Chair?
Come again?
What are you trying to say about Mr. Lawrence McDonald?
No, I'm just saying I was inspired by you this morning. We'll come
Chair,
back
on
to
a point
McDonald's
of order. On a point of order, Chair.
Wrongly as the Chairperson. Wrongly.
Oh, Omanda.
Long live.